DeRay McKesson is the 30-year-old activist with the signature blue vest that he wears every day without fail, who became one of the faces of the Black Lives Matter movement. You may remember him from this moment last year after CNN's Wolf Blitzer asked him about the rioting in Baltimore that followed the death in a police van of Freddie Gray, perhaps expecting him to condemn it.
But at least 15 police officers have been hurt, 200 arrests, 144 vehicle fires. These are statistics local police have put out, 15 structure fires. There's no excuse for that kind of violence, right?
Yeah, and there's no excuse for the 7 people that the Baltimore City Police Department has killed in the past year either, right?
We're not making comparisons. Obviously, we don't want anybody hurt, but I just want to hear there should be peaceful protests, not violent protests, in the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King.
There should be peaceful protests, and I don't have to condone it to understand it, right? That the pain that people feel is real, and you are making a comparison.
Well, Wolf Blitzer repeatedly tried to get DeRay McKesson to say that there was no excuse for that violence. It went on for quite a while. It went viral. Well, now DeRay McKesson may work directly with the Baltimore police. He's running for mayor of the city, joining a crowded field that includes a state senator, city council members, and a former mayor. That's down the road, November. But we wondered, what are the questions an activist has to ask when he seeks to become a part of the establishment he protested? DeRay McKesson joins us to talk about crossing the bridge from activist to politician. Hi, DeRay.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, and good to speak with you. But question, as mayor, would your answer to that question from Wolf Blitzer have to be different? Wouldn't you have to say, for the safety of your city, that yes, violence is unacceptable?
Yep. So what I know to be true is that I don't have to condone it to understand it. It is what I said to Wolf. It is what I'll say again, is that during that period in time, people were upset. And what got us to that moment was the city making a poor decision to trap students in one space and have them greeted with 300 officers. And that led to what you saw on TV being the unrest. And that was avoidable. If Freddie Gray was alive, nobody would have been outside. And if the police hadn't provoked people, then we wouldn't have had that. So as mayor, I would have made sure that we would not have gotten to that point.
Well, but if, you know, every mayor hopes not to get to that point. But once you do, what do you say? And do you have to quit the movement, the Black Lives Matters movement?
Yeah, so, you know, I push on this notion of from protest to politics, right? Mm-hmm. The protest in and of itself is actually one of the most political acts in this America. That pushing the government to be the best it can be is, you know, is the American Revolution, it is the Boston Tea Party, that is actually at the root of what it means to be a citizen. I think that what I'm saying is running for mayor is that it's important that people continue to push from the outside. It's important that people push from the inside. And that's the only way that we'll get the transformative change that people deserve, you know?
Yeah. Well, what about the people in Baltimore who might be wary of you because their family members are the police and the people whose job it is to go out and keep the city safe? What do you represent them too? What do you say to them?
Yeah, so this has never been an attack on police. This has been a critique about the culture of policing and what the culture of policing does in communities in ways that is really dangerous, both here and in places across the country. So it is important that we hold the police accountable, just like we'd hold any other public servant accountable, but hold them accountable differently in the sense that they have the power to take life, and that is unique. But also understanding that the issue of safety in our communities is more expansive than policing, that safety is about jobs and education and health. If I ask you to close your eyes and think about where you feel the most safe, it is likely not in a room full of police. It's likely where your family is, where there's shelter and food, where you're loved, where there's opportunities and resources. And the police, at their best, do 3 things, right? They prevent crime, they respond to crime, and they solve crime. And in all 3 of those buckets, they need the trust of the community to do it. So I believe that if we restore the trust, that we will change the way that police are experiencing communities in ways that will preserve life and make everyone safer.
Well, I've been asking about maybe pushback from, you know, citizens. What about from within the movement? You met with President Obama on February 18th, but you were then criticized by members of the movement, at least one, Aislinn Pulley. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. She's ahead of the Chicago Black Lives, and she didn't think it was appropriate to be part of a photo op with the president. People, like any president, even the first black president, are perceived as part of the problem. So might you be forced to choose by people within the Black Lives Matter movement?
So I would agree with her about not being in photo ops. That is correct. It's unfortunate that she chose not to attend the meeting so that she would have seen that it actually wasn't a photo op, that President Obama extended the meeting by 30 minutes specifically so he could take questions only from the younger activists, of which she would have been one. And we had a thoughtful conversation both with President Obama and with members of the administration, the senior administration, and we continue to follow up with them about important issues around use of force and other things like police union contracts and body cameras. So it was a fruitful conversation. You know, the movement's a diverse space, and we won't always agree about tactics, but we all want to live in the same world, a world that is just and equitable and fair. And what's real is that there are things that we can do today that will change people's lives today.
Well, you're talking about reforming the rent court that provides over eviction cases in Baltimore. You want to hire more inspectors to take stock of the high child lead poisoning rates in the city. There was just a huge investigative piece. Freddie Gray was
We can end cash bail, you know. There's some real things that we can actually do to change people's lives today, tomorrow, and the day after. And we have to focus on that while we also focus on long-term systemic change. It's not an either or, as some people, I think, dangerously portray it. It is a both and.
Well, would you, for instance, want to bring a grocery store to every resident? We know there are food deserts in cities like Baltimore, huge swaths where people can't buy anything healthy and sometimes no food at all. How do you do that?
It doesn't actually have to be this, you know, 10,000 square foot building. We can think about small businesses and communities differently. And also food trucks. Like there's a host of ways that we can make sure that people have access to healthy food that is not just having a super fresh.
Your life in the movement has prepared you for politics because you rose, as we said, to the top and therefore were a target. Some local residents in Baltimore wondered, why'd you leave? You know, you could have, there were Michael Brown stories right here in Baltimore. One young man famously got up and addressed you at a meeting. Within the movement, there were people critical of your leadership. Some said you were a carpetbagger. There's that hashtag, go home to Ray. And then there are conservatives, Fox News' Tucker Carlson, call you a race hustler. What do you say to people who think that you're an opportunist, that you're making hay out of the country's tragedies?
You know, this is deeply personal to me. So I think about, you know, I was a sixth grade math teacher, and in every day in my work before Mike Brown's death and definitely after was about making sure that the world was a better place for all the kids I taught and kids like them. And when Mike got killed, it was this thing about, like, you got to be alive to learn, that I'm doing all this work to make sure people have great, kids have great teachers. But there's so many kids who will never, ever go to a classroom again. Mike Brown will never have a college professor. Tamir Rice will never have a high school teacher. Ayanna Jones will never have a high school teacher. That matters to me. And it fundamentally changed the way that I thought about the world. To the people that are upset that I did not know about the Mike Browns in Baltimore, Tyrone West, and others, the reality is that there's something that wakes us up. We aren't born woke. And it wasn't until Mike's death that I understood police violence as a systemic thing. I had always understood the skepticism of police, but I just didn't understand it as a widespread thing. And I say that as somebody who had a gun pulled on me in Baltimore in 2009 at a traffic stop by a police officer. So it even happened to me, and I didn't understand that it was systemic. And I think that the reality is that the advent of technology has allowed us to share stories in ways that just didn't exist before. And Baltimore's home, you know, so I think about my father and his story so much as a recovered addict, and I've seen people recover.
You mentioned that in passing when it is really a stunning story. Both your parents were drug addicts. Your mom left. Your dad eventually got sober, but just 20 years ago, you grew up with an addict for a dad and a grandma who stepped in. People, you know, might wonder, how do you survive that? Then you end up at Bowdoin College in Maine. Is there something in you that you maybe want to also find in other young kids? Two addicts for parents.
Yeah, so my father and mother deeply loved me and my sister. And my father, you know, my mother left when I was three. My father raised us with my great-grandmother. You know, I grew up in so many ways in a community of recovery, seeing people put their lives back together, seeing people do what others said that they could not do. And that is as much of my story as it is the story of a city like this. And part of the reason that I'm running. You know, if anything, I think that any success I've ever experienced has been because people who didn't have to care about me did. And they pushed me to see things in myself that I did not see in myself at the time. And that is what I try to do as a teacher. It's why I taught. I think about all of my students who were math phobic, who didn't believe that they could learn math, who didn't understand, who didn't think they were smart enough. And by the end, they understood that they already had the gifts. And my job was to help them access them. And I believe that.
DeRay McKesson, one last question. You are openly gay. You send out stories about your personal life in six words. People can follow and know your life. Very open about it. We were reading an article in which you were meeting up with a reporter. And as you got there, you made chit chat with her about how you were trying to make eyes with some guy that you passed in the street. Very open. Can you do that as mayor?
Yeah, I'm a whole person. You know, I have less time to talk about those things publicly because I'm talking about so many heady issues like injection sites or methadone clinics. But I'm sensitive to being a whole person in any space that I show up in.
Yeah. That's DeRay McKesson, the Black Lives Matter activist now running to be mayor of his hometown of Baltimore. DeRay, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.